We're back now for our third study today, and this is an exciting section of the book of Joshua because it has to do with the redemption of all Israel. That's why our title is Covenants of Redemption for All Israel. And we shall see that as we proceed through Joshua chapter 8. Let's just first of all, though, establish the context of the type that is before us. After the terrible sufferings of the Gogian invasion and Armageddon, where obviously it's a Holocaust, two-thirds of the people in the land, says Zechariah 13, verse 8, will be destroyed in that awful event. The refined third of Judah get involved in the aftermath and indeed the fight. And the verse that I think we need to focus on in regard to this section of the type is Zechariah 14 and verse 14. It says this, "And Judah also shall fight at Jerusalem, and the wealth of all the nations around about shall be gathered together, gold and silver and apparel in great abundance." Now, when you look at that verse, it's clearly after the great earthquake, which is the subject matter of the earlier verses of Zechariah chapter 14, and the revelation of Christ to the surviving Jews in the land. This is a time when they've obviously been purified from their uncleanness, and they're now ready to actually go out on behalf of Christ and to take up the fight with the surrounding nations. It says they fight at Jerusalem, and what that means, of course, is they're directed by the Lord Jesus Christ from Jerusalem. That is their base of operations. And they're going to deal, as we shall see, they're going to deal with the immediate surrounding nations of Israel. So, let's see what we've got here. I'm just trying to get my equipment to work. Try this one. Here we go. I just wanted to put up this chart because it is it coming up? Not sure what's happened there. But anyway, we'll get Nick to have a look at the situation.
It's up.
It's up, yeah. Not on our screen, so I'm wondering about that. Okay.
Yeah, it's good to go, Jim. Go ahead.
Okay, all right. Now, I've got the chart in front of me, but it's not in front of those that are with me. That will come up eventually, I guess. But this chart is very important in establishing the events of what we call here the Jubilee period, 50 years from the return of Christ to raise the dead to the time when he is ruling over all nations at peace and establishes his kingdom fully. And so in the 10 years, we believe, before Armageddon, we've got the events we spoke of in an earlier session. We have events that begin prior to Armageddon, such as Elijah's mission to scatter Jury. It begins 3.5 years before Armageddon, we believe. He doesn't have a great deal of success because the Jews will have no reason to leave behind what they treasure. Similarly, the work of Christ and the saints in subduing the Arab peoples in the immediate area of the judgment seat for the reception of fleeing Jews at the time of Armageddon, that work will be undertaken, as indeed will be the next event, and we've got the chart up on our screen now. The next event is the smiting and healing of Egypt, a process that will take 40 years. Now, if you're looking at this chart, you will see that beyond Armageddon, we have a period of 40 years. And we say in the top of the chart, Yahweh Sabaoth, that is Christ and the saint, manifested in power for 40 years, but their glory will be unseen by the world. And we'll deal with that a little later on in our studies. Elijah's mission, of course, is to bring back scattered Jewry from all parts of the earth, and we pointed out that that's probably something in excess of 8 million people. They won't all be survivors of the events of Armageddon, but there will be a lot of them. That goes on for 40 years, and you can establish the length of the second Exodus from Micah chapter 7 and verse 15, where we are told that the length of the second Exodus will be the same as the first. You've got the work of the amongst the Arabs and the smiting and healing of Egypt, which are that green bar on the chart. And then we've got the events that immediately follow in the land. As we've been talking about, Judah will be saved and settled in the land. That will take some time over that period. Gog will be buried. His forces will have a mausoleum built for them in the land, as we're told in Ezekiel chapter 39, and the land will be cleansed and divided amongst the tribes of Israel. While that's going on, you can see that blue box there, which sits up against Armageddon. That's the mid-heaven proclamation of 10 years. That's Revelation chapter 14, verses 6 and 7. And then what follows is a red box in which we've got the beginning of it, Rome destroyed, and then a 30-year period called in the Apocalypse the Hour of Judgment. There are actually two 30-year periods, but we won't go into that now. This is the Hour of Judgment in which the Roman system, Babylon the Great, is destroyed. Meanwhile, in the last box, the orange box at the bottom of that chart, you have the nations like Britain who will submit to Christ after the events of Armageddon. And we're going to talk about them in this study in chapter 9 of Joshua. It's a marvelous type of that submission by the nations. But we're going to see how they submit and what happens to them. They will be involved in the building of the temple, which will take something like 40 years to accomplish. And ultimately, of course, you have the marriage supper of the Lamb, which comes towards the end of that 40-year period. It will only happen, brothers and sisters, as Revelation 19 tells us, will only happen when Christ has destroyed the false bride, the system that claims to be the bride of Christ, the Catholic harlot system. When he's exposed that system to be the harlot that she is and has destroyed its leadership, that's when he will reveal his true bride to the world. There will be a marriage supper of the Lamb in the presence of those nations who have submitted to him. And ultimately, of course, all nations will submit to Christ. So that's just a brief overview of this period. There are many, many things that are going to happen in that 40 years beyond Armageddon, in which we will be personally involved as part of the Yahweh Sabaoth army that will go forth. And there'll be many things to do. But this is just a synopsis, a précis of what's contained in that 40 years. It will be helpful as we proceed with our study. Now, I hesitate to put this up again because of it's the broken record again, but I think it's very, very important that those who might not have been with us in the first couple of studies appreciate how important this is. When you come to interpret Bible prophecy, when the subject of the prophecy is the people, not the land, this is the rule that applies. The names Israel, Ephraim, and the remnant of Jacob always refer to the Jews outside the land at the return of Christ, while the term Judah refers to the Jews who are in the land at the return of Christ. And we saw how important that was in relation to the type in our previous study. So this is what's before us in chapter 8. Joshua 8 is about the defeat of Ai. In the type, it refers to the time when purified Judah, that is the Jews in the land, after Armageddon, will be victorious over the surrounding nations. And chapter 8 then goes on to speak about all Israel, who will ultimately enter into a new covenant as a result of the work of Elijah, who will bring the Jews from outside the land back to the land in the second Exodus. So that's what's before us in chapter 8. So let's just follow the detail. Let's begin with Joshua chapter 8 and verse 1. And Yahweh said unto Joshua, fear not, neither be thou dismayed. Take all the people of war with thee, and arise, go up to Ai. See, I have given into thy hand the king of Ai and his people and his city and his land. So Joshua did not lead the first disastrous campaign against Ai, remember, in chapter 7. It was a disaster. They lost men in that campaign. They came back with their tail between their legs. He was not involved. So you see, now he is involved. And Joshua here is the type of our Lord Jesus Christ. It's he who takes charge of this campaign against Ai. And this second campaign is a type, as I said, of Zechariah 14, verse 14, where Judah shall fight. The Jews in the land who have been purified by Christ, they will be involved in the subjugation of the surrounding nations. In verse 2 of this chapter we read, and thou shalt do to Ai and her king as thou didst unto Jericho and her king, only the spoil thereof, and this is different, of course, isn't it, to what the commandment was concerning Jericho, the spoil thereof and the cattle thereof shall ye take for a prey unto yourselves, lay thee in ambush for the city behind it. So in contrast to Jericho, where everything had to be destroyed, except for the four medals and the image, as we saw, now Israel can take possession of all of the spoils of war. And that's exactly, you remember, it's exactly what Zechariah 14, verse 14 said, that they will acquire great wealth, silver and the gold. Now, where's that going to come from? Well, it's going to come from the surrounding nations whom they will have to subdue post-Armageddon. You know, you can just think for a while about the response of nations like Iran, for example, to the events of Armageddon. They're not going to be terribly happy with what's happened. And there are other nations there like Syria, like Iraq, like Afghanistan, who will be part of the Gogian Confederacy that will not be all that happy. And so they're going to have to be subdued. And that subjugation will see the acquisition of great wealth by Israel, which, of course, is going to be involved in the building of the temple. Now, what you have in front of you is a picture. It's, I think it might, in fact, be a Google Maps picture of the area of Ai. And it's right in the middle. That red dot you can see in the middle there of that picture is where Tel Hai is today. Now, we were there in 2010, and I'm going to show you a couple of pictures in a moment that we took when we stood on that tel. But just get our bearings straight here. I'm going to use the cursor. I don't know whether you can actually see this cursor, but I'm just going to use the cursor to point out a few things. Over here, we have a town in the West Bank called Beitin. That is, of course, ancient Bethel. Ancient Bethel was somewhere in this region. And down here, we have Tel Hai. And to the southeast of that, we have a little town called Dibwan. It's a Palestinian town, and we were there. And by the way, the Palestinians there are quite wealthy. There are a lot of very, very nice houses in this little town called Dibwan. And we spoke to them, and they said, you know, we just want peace with Israel. We don't want war with Israel. They just want to enjoy their swimming pools and all of the benefits of their lovely houses. They don't want war with Israel. And that was the spirit that we got from these people. Now, you see here, this highway, Highway 60, that runs along the central massif of the mountains of Israel, and this is where, of course, Gog's going to come down upon these mountains of Israel. It will be part of Israel proper, as Ezekiel 38, verse 8 tells us. It won't be a Palestinian state. There will be a Palestinian state, but it'll be down in the area of Gaza, and that's provable from Zephaniah chapter 2, verse 11 and onwards, and from Joel chapter 3, verse 4. We won't go into that now. But this road, we drove on that road for a little while because the Palestinians are not allowed to use it. Israel built this as a road for military vehicles so that they can quickly access the whole of the West Bank when they need to, like they did recently in Jenin to the north. And somewhere here between Bethel and Hai on the top of this mountain here, and you'll see it in a moment, that's where Abraham came in Genesis chapter 12, you remember. And there he had to make a choice between Hai on the east, that is ruin, that's what that name means, and Bethel on the west, which means the house of God. So Abraham had to make that choice. We know what choice he made. Now, he built an altar here, of course, as well, and sacrificed unto Yahweh. So you got a bit of a picture. You see this darkish area here on the map? That's the Valley of Achor. That's the door of hope of the future. And it's important to what we're going to deal with because what I want to show you is how Joshua went about what we just read in Joshua 8, setting up the ambush. Now, this little picture you can see down the bottom left-hand corner of the screen is taken from the ruins of Ai, looking virtually due west towards Bethel. You see this rise up here? That's probably where Abraham set up his altar, because over that rise is the little town of Bethel. And we're looking almost due west, and we're looking, if you can sort of see, there's a valley that runs. This goes down into a valley. It's a hidden valley. So from Ai, you cannot see over this rim here, this lip. And so that's why 30,000 could be sent in the night. They came up the Valley of Achor from Gilgal, and they set themselves just to the west here over that lip. They couldn't be seen by the men of Ai and the men of Bethel who had joined them. Then we have, if you just look up here, north of Ai, this is what you see. Now, you can see here in the front the rubble of the old town of Ai. And looking due north, you see there's a patch of trees up here on that hill. That's beyond the Valley of Achor. Now, that is where Joshua set the rest of Israel. And what they did is they came south through the valley, come up over the lip here so you could actually see them, and that's what induced the men of Ai and Bethel to come out of the city. And then the men of Israel retreated across the valley back up onto the hill. And when they did that, Joshua raised his spear, and the men who were sitting over here, hidden to the west, rose up, came to the city, went through the gates, and burnt it. Now, the rest, of course, is history, as we saw in the record of Joshua chapter 8. But it just gives you a bit of a feel. It's probably nice, isn't it? To sort of feel as though you're there just to see how these events unfolded. But there's a great type involved here, as we're going to see. This is part of the fulfillment of the prophecies of Zechariah and other places in the Word. This, what happens here is typical of that. So with that, we can move on. Now, here's another important element of our subject here today. In Daniel chapter 2, one of the most well-known chapters in the Old Testament, I think, to most of us, in both verse 35 and verse 45, you have very similar words. And it provides the order of the destruction of the image of Nebuchadnezzar. When it's toppled by the stone power, the stone that smote the image, it says, became a great mountain and filled the whole earth. For 40 years, the nations who were part of this confederacy, part of the kingdom of men, are going to be crushed. But there's an order. It says, then was the iron, the clay, the brass broken to pieces and crushed. Now, we know who these represent. The Gogian Confederacy has, of course, as in the leadership, Russia. And Russia will be headquartered when they make the invasion to the south into the land of Israel. They'll be headquartered in Constantinople. And if you had to choose a metal for Constantinople, what would you choose? Well, you would choose brass. That was the home of the Greek Orthodox religion, remember? So the metal for them is brass. And if you want proof of that, you can go to Daniel chapter 7 and you will find that the fourth beast has, interestingly enough, claws of brass. It's got teeth of iron, which identifies Rome. Now, what do you do with your teeth? Well, you consume something with your teeth. And Rome is endeavoring to consume its object of its hatred. But what do you do with the claws? Well, with the claws, you capture what you're going to eat with your teeth, don't you? And, of course, they come from Constantinople. The claws are of brass, but the teeth are of iron. So you get the picture of that? What we have here in the brass and iron is this confederacy of peoples led by Russia, which has as its base of operations Constantinople. But they are allied with the European democracies under the papal system. And, of course, democracy speaks about people, and democracy can be symbolised by clay. Brother Sully makes that very clear in a very wonderful comment he makes in his book on the temple. So brass, iron and clay are the first to be destroyed. Now, that, of course, happens primarily in the events of Armageddon. But what about the next one to be ground to powder? Well, it's the silver. Silver, of course, represented the chest and the arms of the image of Nebuchadnezzar. It's the kingdom of the Medo-Persians, largely to the east, but not just to the east. So this is about the surrounding nations, the region immediately adjacent to Israel. And these, I believe, are the subject of what we have in the title. This is what Zechariah 14, verse 14 is about. It's about the subjugation of those nations immediately adjacent to Israel. But who comes last in this grinding process that takes 40 years to accomplish? Well, the gold, because the head of the image was Babylon. symbolized by gold. And it is the last power to be destroyed. It's Babylon the Great that lasts the longest. And they're ultimately utterly destroyed. So here we have in Daniel chapter 2, verse 35, and in verse 45, the order of the destruction of the image. There's also an order for the deliverance of Jacob. There are two stages to the deliverance of Jacob. Now, why do we use the term Jacob? Well, I'd like to read to you, and you might want to just jot this down or have a look yourself. In Romans chapter 11, this is what the Apostle Paul says. I'm going to read verse 25 for connection. He says this: "For I would not, brethren, that ye should be ignorant of this secret, lest ye should be wise in your own conceits, that blindness in part has happened to Israel until the fullness of the Gentiles be come in. And so all Israel shall be saved." Now, who is all Israel? Well, he means, as you're going to see in our study today, he means all Israel, the whole nation, not just the Jews in the land, but the Jews outside the land who are gathered by Elijah. He says, "And so all Israel shall be saved, as it is written, there shall come out of Zion the deliverer and shall turn away ungodliness from Jacob." It doesn't say Israel. It doesn't say Judah. It says Jacob. Why Jacob? Well, Jacob is the generic name for the whole nation. Jacob represents the whole nation. It matters not where they are, whether they're in the land at the return of Christ or outside the land, doesn't matter. They're described as Jacob. That's why the remnant of Jacob is one of the terms used of those outside the land. Perfect consistency. So when you look at this chart that you can see on the screen, stage one is Judah is saved at the events of Armageddon. Now, we've been talking about that. And when they're purified and prepared, they are used to help subdue the local enemies like Syria and Iran. Can anybody imagine that Iran is just going to meekly submit to Christ after Armageddon? I don't think so. They're going to have to be converted. And by the way, it will be easier to convert Muslims than Catholics, because Muslims believe in one God. They do believe in a prophet. They believe Jesus Christ was a prophet. So it's not all that difficult to convert them. Virtually impossible to convert Catholics. Though, in fact, by the grace of God, some Catholics have come into the truth in the last 180 years of our community. There's a second stage. And that's the second exodus of Israel. But this begins before Armageddon. 3.5 years, we think we can demonstrate from Malachi 4 and Luke chapter 1. We can demonstrate that the mission of Elijah begins 3.5 years, like John the Baptist, before Christ came on the scene. He will go out and he will warn the Jews outside the land. He doesn't have a mission in the land, by the way. That's one mistake that's been made in recent times. His mission is outside the land. But they won't listen to him, even though they've left a chair vacant in many places for him to sit in, and he'll sit in it one day. But they won't listen to him any more than they listened to Hezekiah's messengers, who went into Israel in the north to invite them to the Passover that he held. But when Armageddon has destroyed all that they trust in, when their banks are gone, when their posh homes are gone, when there's no more Cadillacs to drive, that's when they will be ready to leave. And they'll be gathered, and it will take 10 years, we believe, to get them where they have to be, into Europe. A bit more about that in a second. So when they get into Europe, they will have a mission, and their mission is to be the vehicle of judgment against Babylon the Great, a Catholic system that will be in utter rebellion against Christ. And they will have to fight their way through Catholic Europe. It won't be easy. That process will see the purging out of the rebels. Ezekiel 20 talks about that. And there will be a new generation that arrive at the borders of the land, having been baptized in the Euphrates or the Red Sea, and will enter into the land to take up their inheritance. That's the two stages in the deliverance of Jacob. Just a review again of that chart that we saw in the previous study, this second exodus of Israel, 40 years under Elijah's leadership, his mission is to get all of the Jews outside the land into Europe. Now, it's called the wilderness of the peoples. Can I show you this? I'd like you to come to Ezekiel chapter 20. This is one of the most important passages in relation to the second exodus of Israel. There are many of them, but this is extremely clear. Ezekiel 20 and at verse 33. As I live, saith Adonai Yahweh, surely with a mighty hand and with a stretched out arm and with fury poured out will I rule over you. And I will bring you out from the peoples, it's a plural word in the Hebrew, and will gather you out of the countries wherein ye are scattered with a mighty hand and with a stretched out arm and with fury poured out. So it's going to be a very troubled time for those who encounter Israel and for Israel itself. And I will bring you into the wilderness of the peoples, plural. Now, where is this wilderness of the peoples? Well, I'll show you in a second. There's only one in the scripture. Verse 36, like as I pleaded with your fathers in the wilderness of the land of Egypt, so will I plead with you. And the word plead actually has the idea of judge, but there's a purging process involved. And he says in verse 37, I will cause you to pass under the rod, there's your purging. I will bring you into the bond of the covenant, and I will purge out from among you the rebels. So this 40 years in the wilderness of the peoples is designed to purge out the older generation, the hardened, the faithless, just like their wilderness forefathers. He says, I will bring them forth out of the country where they sojourn, so not one Jew will be left behind. And then we read a very interesting statement in verse 38. You ever thought about this? He says, I will bring them forth out of the country where they sojourn, and they shall not enter into the land of Israel. Really? Yes, you see, it's exactly the same as when they came out of Egypt under Moses. The entire older generation, except for Joshua and Caleb and the Levites, we believe, perished in the wilderness. They didn't get into the land of promise, and it's going to be the same all over again. In fact, in another place, in Jeremiah chapter 3, he says, I'm going to take one of a city and two of a family and bring them out. So it's going to be a process of purging and refinement. It's not going to be easy, and it's certainly not going to be painless. He goes on to say why, but he says, if ye will not hearken unto me, he says, but pollute ye my holy name no more, in verse 39. So that was the problem. They had polluted his name and they had to be purged of their idolatry. So I think you can see how Ezekiel 20 verses 33 to 38 is a very important. But the other reference here on the screen is right in the middle, under wilderness of the peoples, and that's Revelation 17. And I think we should look at that one as well. Just to establish the type here. Revelation 17 and at verse 3. Now, he makes, just to connect it, at the end of verse 1, he talks about judgment of the great whore that sitteth upon many waters, with whom the kings of the earth have committed fornication, and the inhabitants of the earth have been made drunk with the wine of her fornication. Now, we know who this is. This is the Catholic harlot system. Verse 5 tells you that. So where is she? Verse 3. So he carried me away in the spirit into the wilderness, and I saw a woman sit upon a scarlet-coloured beast, full of names of blasphemy, having seven heads and 10 horns. Now, where is she? Well, she's in a wilderness. What kind of wilderness is this? Well, look at verse 15. And he saith unto me, the waters which thou sawest, where the whore sitteth, are peoples, and multitudes, and nations, and tongues. It's a wilderness of peoples. It's the only one in the Bible. It is Central Europe, where Catholicism will be based post-Armageddon in opposition to the rule of Christ. And, of course, we know that this is about Rome. We've had some silly nonsense spoken about this chapter in our community in recent decades, but it's quite clear what this is about. Look at verse 18 of Revelation chapter 17. And the woman which thou sawest is that great city which reigneth, and the word is in the present tense, which reigneth over the kings of the earth. Well, who could that have been in AD 96 when the apocalypse was delivered to John on the Isle of Patmos? Who could that be? There was only one power that was ruling over the kings of the earth at that time. That was the power of Rome. So it's about the Roman Empire. And this chapter, of course, is all about the latter-day Roman Empire, the revived Holy Roman Empire, which will be, of course, what will be established here in Central Europe post-Armageddon. The whole point, of course, we know, the whole point of the the European Economic Community, as it was first called in 1956, the EEC, now, of course, the European Union, the whole point of it was to re-establish the Reich. It was to be the Fourth Reich. It was to restore what Charlemagne had established in the First Reich, the Holy Roman Empire. And they won't be successful until after Armageddon. That's very clear from the prophecies. Christ will deal with the first phase, the beast of the sea phase. He will deal with the harlot on the beast. But once Rome has been destroyed, they have to find a new base. They will go to where Charlemagne established the Holy Roman Empire. They will go to Central Europe, to Germany and the surrounding nations. And that's where Israel will be brought by Elijah, to the wilderness of the peoples. And they'll have to fight their way back to the land. They will have come from the land of the north, where they, of course, will be held captive by the Russian power. They'll be released from the land of the north. And then they'll be involved in this 30 years of conflict to destroy the power of Rome, the power of Babylon the Great. And they'll make their way back to the land, and the rebels will be purged out in that whole process, and they'll be brought into the bonds of the covenant, baptized into Christ, as it were, in the Euphrates and the Red Sea. That's the story that's before us. And that's what Joshua chapter 8 is about. It begins with Christ purging and dealing with the Jews in the land post-Armageddon. He uses them as a vehicle of warfare. It ends with the salvation of all Israel being brought into the covenant, and the work of Elijah will do that purging and bring them back to the land. I hope that's reasonably clear to everyone. So let's come back then to Joshua chapter 8. Now I want to show you something quite remarkable in this chapter. Right up to, if you have a look at verse 29, you have the events concerning the overthrow of Ai. Verse 29 says, "And the king of Ai, he hanged on a tree until eventide. And as soon as the sun was down, Joshua commanded that they should take his carcass down from the tree and cast it at the entering of the gate of the city, and raise thereon a great heap of stones." You might have seen the picture of the great heap of stones to the north of the city. That's where the gate was. "And that remaineth there unto this day." So, look at verse 30. "Then Joshua built an altar unto Yahweh, God of Israel, in Mount Ebal." Excuse me? Really? This is, as we say in the comment, this is a dramatic development. Just think about the logistics of what's happening here. You've got scores of thousands of soldiers who have captured Ai, they've destroyed it, they've covered it in a heap of stones. They've got to go back down the Valley of Achor. They've got to go quite a few miles to get back to Gilgal, where the encampment of Israel is. They get home, they're all dirty and sweaty, and, you know, I'm just trying to paint the picture. The very next thing we hear in this record is that the whole nation is up at Shechem on Mount Ebal. Really? That's a three-day journey for the whole nation. And what are they up there for? Well, we're told that they're up there to renew the covenant. So the whole nation was encamped on the plains of Jordan at Gilgal, as we find in Joshua chapter 5, verse 10, and they're back there again in chapter 9, verse 6. But they're all up at Mount Ebal near Shechem. Look at verses 33 and 35 of Joshua chapter 8. Verse 33 says this, and notice the phraseology, "And all Israel and their elders and officers and their judges stood on this side the ark and on that side before the priests, the Levites, which bear the ark of the covenant of Yahweh, as well as the stranger, as he that was born among them, half of them over against Mount Gerizim and half of them over against Mount Ebal. as Moses, the servant of Yahweh, had commanded before, that they should bless the people of Israel. But look at verse 35. Is it just the priests and the officers and the judges? No. Verse 35 says, there was not a word of all that Moses commanded, which Joshua read not before all the congregation of Israel, with the women and the little ones and the strangers that were conversant among them. The whole nation was up there. Now, just think about the logistics of that. When the soldiers get back to Gilgal and clean themselves up, Joshua says to the whole nation, pack up. Pack up your tents. Pack up everything. We're going up to Shechem. Now, it's about 30 miles away. It's going to take them at least 2 days, if not 3 days, to get there, to get the whole nation up there. And when they get there, half the nation is installed on Mount Gerizim to the north, and half on, Mount Gerizim to the south and Mount Ebal to the north. So you've got half on each mountain. And we're going to see exactly what happens here. And we're going to see that this is all about the induction of the entire nation into the covenants that God has made with that people through Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, fulfilled in the work of our Lord Jesus Christ. It's a remarkable time. So what about this Mount Ebal, where we read in verse 30, Joshua built an altar unto Yahweh Elohim of Israel in Mount Ebal. It means bull, the bear mountain. And when you go, if you've been to Shechem and you looked up at Mount Ebal, there's not a tree on it. There's a few towers, you know, sort of technology towers, but you won't find any trees. In verse 31, we read this. As Moses, the servant of Yahweh, commanded the children of Israel, as it is written in the book of the law of Moses, an altar of whole stones over which no man lift up any iron. Iron? Yeah, iron is the symbol of Rome. Nothing to do with Rome in this, because they will have been cleansed of the things that belong to Rome when Elijah's finished his work and when Christ has purified the Jews in the land after Armageddon. They'll be cleansed of any connection to that. And we know from Revelation chapter 18, verse 4, that Yahweh calls his people out of Rome because some of them do have a connection with it. Now, you see the passages on the screen that have been underlined. I want to take you there. I want to show you that what we're reading here in Joshua chapter 8 is a fulfillment of what was required by these two places in Deuteronomy. Deuteronomy chapter 11 and verses 29 and 30. Deuteronomy 11, verse 29. And it shall come to pass, when Yahweh thy God hath brought thee in unto the land whither thou goest to possess it, that thou should put the blessing upon Mount Gerizim and the curse upon Mount Ebal. Are they not on the other side Jordan, by the way where the sun goeth down, in the land of the Canaanites, which dwell in the champains, over against Gilgal, beside the plains or oaks of Moreh? Okay, so he's clearly indicating that when they got there, they had a special task to perform. And it's spelled out even more clearly in Deuteronomy 27. We come to Deuteronomy 27 and verses 4 to 7. Chapter 27, verse 4. Therefore it shall be, when ye be gone over Jordan, that ye shall set up these stones, which I command you this day, in Mount Ebal. And thou shalt plaster them with plaster. And there shalt thou build an altar unto Yahweh thy God, an altar of stones. Then comes this commandment. Thou shalt not lift up any iron tool upon them. Keep Rome out of it. Then thou shalt build the altar of Yahweh thy God of whole stones, and thou shalt offer burnt offerings thereon unto Yahweh thy God. And thou shalt offer peace offerings, and shall eat thereof, and rejoice before Yahweh thy God. And then they're told in verse 8, and this happens in Joshua chapter 8, and thou shalt write upon the stones all the words of this law very plainly. You see, they were going to confirm the covenant. That's what was happening. So when you come back here to Joshua chapter 8, what is happening here is a precise fulfillment of those things that we've just read out of Deuteronomy. No iron is to be used. It says they offered burnt and peace offerings to renew their covenant. Now, you'll notice there's no sin offering. Why not? Why isn't there a sin offering involved here? Well, you see, the people of Israel will have been purged. Nearly 40 years before, 37 years before, the Jews in the land would have been purged by Christ. The generation that have come into the land under Elijah will have been purged, and they will have come into the covenant. They will have been freed like you and I, freed from past sins in the waters of baptism. So there's no need for sin offering. This is about the confirmation of the covenants. And we know what burnt offerings represent. They represent rededication. We know what peace offerings represent, and we read about this in Deuteronomy. They were to be consumed by the people because the peace offering represented fellowship with Yahweh. So this is about their rededication to him and their fellowship with him. It's about renewing the covenant. That's why there's no sin offering. And you'll notice in verse 32, it goes on to speak that he wrote there upon the stones a copy of the law of Moses, which he wrote in the presence of the children of Israel. And look at the wording. And all Israel and their elders and officers and their judges stood on this side of the ark and on that side. We read that passage, didn't we? So here is the renewal of the covenant. And this little phrase, all Israel, of course, points to the time when the whole nation will have been redeemed. And again, I want to take you to another passage. You see it on the screen there, Ezekiel 39. Ezekiel 39 is about the period, the 40 years beyond Armageddon and all the things that have to happen in that period. And when you read from Ezekiel 39, we're going to read from verse 23, because you're going to meet a phrase here that's used three times in this section down to the end of the chapter. And that phrase is that Yahweh hid his face from his people. Verse 23. And the nation shall know that the house of Israel went into captivity for their iniquity, because they trespassed against me. Therefore hid I my face from them, no fellowship, and gave them into the hand of their enemies. So fell they all by the sword, according to their uncleanness, and according to their transgressions have I done unto them, and hid my face from them. That's twice. Therefore, thus saith Adonai Yahweh, now will I bring again the captivity of Jacob. Jacob? Yes, the whole nation. And have mercy upon, look at the phrase, the whole house of Israel, and will be jealous for my holy name, after that they have borne their shame and all their trespasses, whereby they have trespassed against me when they dwelt safely in their land, and none made them afraid. So what time period is that, do you think? Well, I'll tell you something, it's not now. Israel does not yet dwell safely or securely in their land. If you step back to chapter 38, have a look at verse 11. Ezekiel 38, verse 11. This is the time when Gog thinks an evil thought in verse 10. And thou shalt say, Gog, I will go up to the land of unwalled villages. It actually means a land of wide open spaces. That's what the Hebrew word means. I will go to them that are at ease, that are at rest, that dwell safely, there's our word, securely. All of them dwelling without walls and having neither bars nor gates. Yes, the green line, the wall around the green line of the West Bank's been taken down. You see, when you read in chapter 39, in verse 26, that their transgressions peaked at a time when they dwelt securely in the land and none made them afraid. So Hezbollah's no problem anymore. The 26,000 rockets that they've got aimed at Israel, that's not a problem anymore. Syria's not a problem anymore. Iran's not a problem anymore because Russia's absorbed them into their confederacy. Israel has got some sort of contract with Russia, as prophecy requires, by the way. The early chapters of Isaiah will tell you that. they are secure. And that's the time that Israel will come to the peak of their iniquity before their God. Already, brethren and sisters, Tel Aviv is regarded as the capital of homosexuality in Europe. And they are proud of it. Netanyahu boasted about it in the United Nations speech several years ago. He boasted about that. So here's a nation that has descended into a corruption that Yahweh can only do one thing. He has hidden his face from them. And he mentions it a third time here in Ezekiel 39. Come down with me to verse 28. Then shall they know that I am Yahweh their God, which caused them to be led into captivity among the nations, but I have gathered them unto their own land and have left none of them any more there. Neither will I hide my face any more from them, for I have poured out my spirit upon the house of Israel, saith Adonai Yahweh. Very important reference in relation to what we're talking about here in this study today. Judah is saved by Christ, stage one. Stage two, the second exodus of Israel will purge that nation. And we've just been reading in Ezekiel 39 about their return into the presence of their God. He's going to hide his face no more from them. Why? Because they will have been brought into the bonds of the covenant, as Ezekiel 20 told us. And all the words of the law here in Joshua 8, verse 34 are read. He read all the words of the law, the blessings and the cursing, but they shouted across the valley between Ebal and Gerizim, according to all that is written in the book of the law. Marvelous things, isn't it? That context, Deuteronomy 31, by the way, the context of Deuteronomy 31 is actually about the Abrahamic covenant. So while they're reading out the words of the Mosaic covenant here in Joshua 8, is pointing to the greater day when the things that belong to the Abrahamic covenant, the one that's described in Jeremiah 33, for example, will become a reality. In verse 35, we read that verse. It's a description, doesn't it? It matches that of Israel when they left Egypt in the wilderness with all of the families, the women and the little ones and the strangers that were conversing among us. Like going back to the Exodus out of Egypt, because what is happening here in the type is the end result of the Exodus out of Babylon the Great. Well, let's come to Joshua 9. I'm not sure how we're going for time here. Let's see what we got. Can you bear with me for a while? Joshua chapter 9. We have in this chapter the deception of the Gibeonites. And this in the type represents the Tarshish powers submitting to Christ, but with deception. They do it feignedly out of fear. And it represents what's going to happen when the nations come after Armageddon to submit to Christ. Not the Catholic nations, of course, but nations, sensible nations like Britain and America, hopefully, and Australia and nations like that. The nations who submit to Christ are preserved but compelled to labor in the temple as servants to Israel. So let's look at Joshua chapter 9, verse 1. And it came to pass when all the kings which were on this side Jordan, in the hills and in the valleys and in all the coasts of the great sea over against Lebanon, now count them, the Hittite and the Amorite, the Canaanite, the Perizzite, the Hivite, and the Jebusite heard thereof. There are six nations there. Six nations unite against Joshua and Israel. It's a type, of course, of the Catholic nations who coalesce around the Pope and initiate their false anti-Christ theory. You know, they've prepared their people for this, haven't they? I mean, even the foolish Pentecostal-type churches have been taken up with this idea of the Antichrist. And they'll say, that man in Jerusalem that's crying out for us to submit, he's the Antichrist we told you about. And, of course, we know the number of the papacy, don't we? It's 666. It's very appropriate that there are six nations here. And they're very worried, these nations, because, you see, it says in verse 2 that they gathered themselves together to fight with Joshua and with Israel with one accord. Yes, we had a look in the previous session at Psalm 2, verses 1 to 3. Why do the nations rage? Why do they gather together? Well, they gather together because of the voice of the Pope, and they will join with him against Christ. But you see, as we say, there are different responses here in this early part of chapter 9. That's the response in verses 1 and 2 with one accord, two Hebrew words, ekad pay. Ekad means one, pay is a reference to the mouth. One mouth, yes, a papal mouth. He's the one, of course, who speaks encyclicals, thinks he's infallible, speaking ex cathedra. So with one papal mouth, so to speak, but there's a different response in verse 3 from some. And when the inhabitants of Gibeon heard what Joshua had done unto Jericho and to Ai, they did work wilily. Yes, the word in the Hebrew means with trickery or shrewdness. Rotherham translates it craftily. Young's literal says with subtlety. And they had ambassadors and made as if they had been ambassadors. They came to Israel, to Joshua and the elders. That word ambassadors means in the Hebrew to act as an envoy. It comes from the root zer, the pivot of a door or a hinge, hence an envoy or an ambassador. So why is that important, do you think? Well, it's important because of the type. Let me show you. This is a comment from the Treasury of Scriptural Knowledge about this word zer, the root of that word ambassadors. And reference here, of course, we believe in the type is to Britain's ambassadors. The word zer, an ambassador, properly denotes a hinge, because an ambassador is a person upon whom the business turns as upon a hinge. So the Latin cardinalis, from which you get cardinals, from cardo, a hinge, was the title of the prime minister of the emperor Theodosius, though now applied only to the pope's electors and counselors. So who are the pope's electors and counselors? Well, the cardinals. Where do they get cardinals from? Well, the inner circle of Semiramis's priests, who wore the red garments that we spoke about in the previous session, were the only ones who had access to her. They controlled the door. They had control of a door which was on hinges. So you get their name, cardo, a hinge. So cardinals who control the door when they want to elect a new pope, for example, they go behind the doors and they elect one from among their number as the new pope. They control a door because, of course, they're cardinals. They're the hinge, as it were, of the door. Get the idea of that? Well, the King of England is the head of the Anglican Church, and the Anglican Church is a carbon copy of Catholicism. When Henry VIII created his own church, the Church of England, he didn't do that because he repudiated the doctrines of Catholicism. In fact, he lopped off a few heads because there were people who wanted to change the doctrines of the Catholic Church. He wasn't keen on the idea of changing the doctrines. So their doctrines, of course, are essentially the same as Catholicism. They are a carbon copy, which is why, of course, Britain is called the daughter of Tyre. In the scripture, Tyre in that place being the type of Catholicism. Get the idea of this? So let me ask you a question. When King Charles comes, because his mother said she'd cast her crown before Christ, when King Charles eventually comes to represent his people to Christ in Jerusalem, do you think he's going to come and say to Christ, look, please, we'd like to become Christadelphians? We'd like to adopt your doctrines. We're going to reject the doctrine of the Trinity and the doctrine of heaven going and all that sort of other rubbish. Do you think he's going to do that? Of course he isn't going to do that. So that's why this type here in Joshua 9 is very important. They come with feigned hearts, do the men, the Gibeonites, and so will the nations who come to submit to Christ shortly after Armageddon. Their initial submission will be with deception in the heart. Now, I want to look at a couple. In fact, you can look at three references here where the same Hebrew word is used. You might want to turn your Bibles to Psalm 66, verse 3, but it's on the screen in front of you. Another reference is Psalm 18, verse 44, which you will find virtually identical to 2 Samuel 22, verse 45. And this word you can see, this word submit in the green on the screen, it's the same word in each of those three references. And this is the word, kakash. It means to be untrue, to deceive, to lie. And Young's literal translation actually has something very similar to what you'll find in the Oxford version of the King James Bible. They come with a deceitful heart. They feign obedience. Hebrew, lie. That's what that word means. They lie. So when they come, they've got no intentions of becoming Christadelphians or brethren of Christ. They come because they have no choice. They come because they can't defeat this power. Their whole nation, their infrastructure has been ruined. They can see no way forward but to submit, but they don't necessarily want to become Christadelphians. They don't want to adopt the doctrines of the truth. So they come and submit with a feigned heart. Get the picture? You will find that in those three places. Psalm 66, verse 3. Now, I think we should actually look at Psalm 66 because it's important when you quote passages like this that you establish the context. What is the context here? In Psalm 66, read from verse 1. It won't take very long reading from the beginning of this psalm to establish what time period we're in. Verse 1, make a joyful noise unto God, all ye lands. Has that happened? No. When will that happen? In the events beyond Armageddon, when the kingdom's established. Sing forth the honour of his name. Make his praise glorious. Say unto God, how terrible art thou in thy works, through the greatness of thy power. That's, of course, a reference to the events of Armageddon, the entire destruction of all that they put their trust in, of all that they have built up. Then it says this, through the greatness of thy power shall thine enemies submit themselves unto thee. Margin, yield feigned obedience. Hebrew, lie. Yeah, you can see the context. Verse 5, come and see the works of God. He is terrible in his doing toward the children of men. And goes on to talk about that. Verse 7, he ruleth by his power forever. His eyes behold the nations. Let not the rebellious exalt themselves. I don't need to read too much more, do I? Pretty obvious that this is about the kingdom being established. So we know the time period. This is what's going to happen after Armageddon. When the nations, some of the nations at least, come to submit to Christ. They don't do it because they want to be brethren of Christ. They do it because they have no choice, just like the Gibeonites of Joshua chapter 9. So have a look with me at Joshua 9, verse 4. They did work wilily or craftily and went and made as if they had been ambassadors and took old sacks upon their asses and wine bottles, old and rent and bound up. Wine bottles? Yeah. Old wine. It's the old wine of Babylon present to deceive. Old shoes in verse 5. Their faulty effete walk. Those shoes are clouted, we read in verse 5. It says old shoes and clouted upon their feet and old garments upon them. And all the bread of their provision was dry and mouldy. This word clouded means patched. It's the character of latter-day Protestant religions, a patched-up religion. Bread, of course, is the symbol for teaching, isn't it? And that bread is dry. The word in the Hebrew means to be ashamed or confused. And what they teach is confusing, and it's very dry, isn't it? It's mouldy or crumbled, like Orthodox Protestant teaching. Ever sat in a sermon? In a church, my mother did when she was coming into the truth over a period of 6 months. She went looking for the truth. She sat in these churches and listened to drivel. It was nonsense, and she knew it was nonsense, and she had no knowledge of the Bible. So, yes, that's a very good description of what we see in the world today. And in verse 6 we read, and they went to Joshua unto the camp at Gilgal, and said unto him and to the men of Israel, we be come from a far country. Now, therefore, make ye a league with us. And that word league is the Hebrew word bereth. It means a covenant. In fact, the word make is karath. So you've got two Hebrew words here, karath, bereth. You know where they first occur? Genesis 15, verse 18. When Yahweh cut a covenant with Abraham and promised his son, his seed, the land of Canaan as an everlasting possession. You know, Christ won't be deceived, of course. He won't be deceived like Joshua was. The truth is the only covenant Christ will make with subject nations, but they will have to convert. And that will be a work of the saints, a work that we're going to have to do, brothers and sisters, to teach them the truth of the word of God. So what happens to these people? Well, I just want to make a couple of more comments about them. Look at verse 17 of Joshua chapter 9. And the children of Israel journeyed and came unto their cities. This is the cities of the Gibeonites on the third day. Now, their cities were Gibeon and Chepirah. Chepirah, it means lioness. And, of course, we know that one of the symbols for Britain is the lion. And Beeroth and Kirjath-Jearim. That plays a very important part, doesn't it, in the scheme of things later on in the Bible. And what happens to them? Well, verse 22, Joshua called for them, and he spake unto them, saying, wherefore have ye beguiled us, saying, we are very far from you when ye dwell among us? Now, therefore, ye are cursed, and there shall none of you be freed from being bondmen and hewers of wood and drawers of water. What for? For the house of my God. And so it will be, brothers and sisters, that the nations who submit to Christ after Armageddon will be put to work in the building of the temple. You read of that in Isaiah 60, verses 9 and 10. The subject nations will be involved in the building of the house of prayer for all nations. And so verse 27 of this chapter says this, and Joshua made them that day hewers of wood and drawers of water for the congregation, for the ecclesia, and for the altar of Yahweh, even unto this day, is in the place which he should choose. Where would that be, I wonder? In the place which Yahweh would choose to put his name, where would that be? Well, obviously, it's Jerusalem, isn't it? And that's where these people were going to end up. And they, of course, were the Nethinims, who came back and helped rebuild the second temple. They proved more faithful very often than the Jews themselves. They were Gentile people who had been joined to Israel, and they were there to serve the altar of Yahweh in Jerusalem. And the nations who submit to Christ are going to be there, not only to help build this place, but they'll be there to worship in it. That's the wonder of this type. In the next study, God willing, we're going to go into chapter 10, and we're going to see the destruction of Babylon the Great. I'll hand it back to Brother Paul.